This is Georgia Focus, a public affairs presentation of this radio station and the Georgia News Network. For the next 30 minutes, we'll feature a discussion about an issue of importance and relevance to you and your neighbors across Georgia.
Welcome to Georgia Focus. I'm John Clark on the Georgia News Network. Our country's multicultural population is at a disproportionately high risk for cardiovascular disease and stroke. The American Heart Association, American Stroke Association, realizes health is more than behaviors and is committed to helping close this gap by addressing the social determinants of health. Here to discuss this today are Dr. Michael Balk. He is a cardiologist and chair of the Metro Atlanta American Heart Association Advisory. Dr. Ayanna Buckner, she is chair of the Metro Atlanta Multicultural Leadership Committee. And also with us is Michael Cortez. He is Government Relations Director for the American Heart Association. Dr. Buckner, we'll begin with you in the subject of the American Heart Association and the social determinants of health. Describe what is meant by that.
Sure. So the World Health Organization defines social determinants of health as the conditions in which people are born, grow, work, live, and age, and the kind of wider set of forces and systems that shape the conditions of daily life. So essentially, all the things that we interact with in our daily lives. In 2015, the American Heart Association released a statement that specifically looked at social determinants of risk and outcomes for cardiovascular disease. So the association is really putting a great deal of emphasis on these in addressing the impact of heart disease.
What are some of those determinants?
Things such as education, where you live, you know, which part of town you live in, which zip code you're in, and we can talk a little bit about how zip code impacts your life, what your job status is. Do you have a job? Is it a low-income job where you may or may not have health insurance or may or may not have food to eat?
So how does that impact someone's health, say their heart health?
Not having access to healthy food puts you at risk for high blood pressure, which is a major risk factor for heart disease. Over time, having the high blood pressure impacts your overall vascular health, or essentially your blood vessels, as well as your heart itself. And so it can put strain on it, and not having access to healthy food or not having a place to exercise or time to exercise can really make a big difference in someone's health.
Dr. Balk, these determinants probably have an impact on blood pressure.
They certainly do. There's actually a recent article that was just published about where you live in relation to gyms. If you happen to not live close to somewhere that you can go exercise, you have more cardiovascular issues. The blood pressure issue is really more related to weight, salt, and lack of exercise. And so if you don't live somewhere where you can walk easily, where you only have fast food restaurants, you're going to be eating far more sodium than is recommended, which is about 1,500 milligrams per day.
That's what you always hear, high blood pressure. Don't eat salt. Back off the salt. Talk about that impact, salt's impact on that, on blood pressure.
Some people are far more salt sensitive than others. So there are patients that really salt does not make much of a difference. But as a population, we can use salt as an easily modifiable tool. If we reduce it, we know that there's decreasing blood pressure, decreased heart failure result, decreased stroke, decreased heart attack. So salt's an easy thing to address because the average American is eating 4 to 6 grams of sodium a day. Mm. And we want it to be under 2,000.
Yeah. Now, it goes beyond than just not adding salt to your food. It's the food you eat as well. That
sure,
stay away
from
something.
There's naturally occurring sodium in many food products. You have to be careful when you go to make something that you think is healthy. The bread has salt. A piece of low-fat cheese has salt. Turkey that comes from the deli market has sodium. And you put it all together into a sandwich, you probably have 800-900 milligrams of sodium, and you haven't even had your chips, breakfast, or dinner.
And Dr. Buckner, talk about that as it pertains to people in other ethnic groups and people in maybe lower-income neighborhoods or rural areas of Georgia and their access to food, and it all correlates together.
Research has found that people in low-income zip codes have 25% fewer chain supermarkets and 1.3 times as many convenience stores compared to middle-income zip codes. What does that mean? If people don't have access to fresh foods, meaning foods that are grown preferably locally, and instead are eating packaged foods or processed foods, you've just heard Dr. Balk talk about salt and salt content. And any food that's processed, whether it's frozen or whether it's in some sort of Vacuum packaging typically has more salt in it, so that fresh food is really important. Also, we found that nearly one-fifth of all people in low-income neighborhoods that have fewer opportunities for living than residents in adjacent higher wealth communities.
Fresh food, fresh prepared food, it costs more just in some cases, and it's also more difficult, as you mentioned, more difficult to get sometimes. You think, oh, I don't have time. I got off work and I have time. I'm just going to swing through a drive-through. Sure. And it takes so much more. And that, obviously, you do that enough times and it becomes a problem.
It really can. And even, you know, you're seeing that many of the fast food restaurants are having cheaper options. Mm-hmm. But what I try to help my patients understand is that you'll most certainly pay for that over time.
Right.
Whether you're paying for it in health expenses such as hospitalizations or co-pays for doctor's visits or for medications themselves. So we really encourage people to look for healthier options. You know, I mentioned the issue about people not having access to supermarkets. And lots of times there are convenience stores around, but most of them don't have the fresh fruits and vegetables that we recommend. And most of the food that's available is packaged or processed, as right. we've talked about.
How do you improve the situation? What are some of your thoughts on that?
Partnerships are really important. So through the American Heart Association's initiatives, we've been exploring ways to do partnerships with schools, whether it's having community gardens or teaching children early on how to make healthier decisions and helping them to really just start to experiment with different tastes and different foods that maybe they hadn't tried before. Because if we can get people to start those practices earlier in life, it's much more likely that they'll continue that.
Yeah. Are you seeing it more in certain ethnic groups?
We absolutely are. Yeah. There are certainly higher rates of vascular disease and heart disease in African Americans as well as in our Latino and Hispanic populations. But what we're finding is even as people immigrate here and come from countries where they may have had healthier outcomes, just spending time here in the U.S., usually over time, they develop the same poor eating habits that we have across the country, and so we see that it changes.
Why is that? Because what are the causes of that?
So again, that brings us back to social determinants of health.
Okay,
it has to do with access. It has to do with cultural practices.
Yeah.
That's certainly a big part of it. But you know where they're living and what's available for them in those areas. Frequently, people are spending much more time working, and frequently don't have time to exercise or don't know how to make it a priority. And so we really try to do education programs and work with patients to help them to understand how to optimize the opportunities that they have.
Yeah.
Basically, they're adopting the Western lifestyle. We see this over and over. Japanese do not get heart disease at the same rate until they move to America.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it's phenomenal. The change that happens within one generation, that's all it takes. The first generation that moves here, they start driving everywhere. They stop eating whole food, plant-based things. They go more towards the fast foods. The next generation, that's all they do. They have the same heart disease risk as a person who's been living here for five generations, even though just two generations prior, they had no heart disease in the family.
So we eat bad and we cause them to eat bad, so our bad habits, so we don't exercise as much. So,
but lifestyle choices can make a difference, and so that's essentially what Dr. Balk has just underscored.
Yeah.
And so I'm a physician who's trained in both internal medicine and preventive medicine, so I spend a large amount of my time trying to convince people to help manage their medical problems through lifestyle changes. So that's making healthy food choices and making exercise, and we like to now call it physical activity because there's kind of less of a bad thought around that, but optimizing physical activity.
Okay. Today we are discussing some of the issues related to heart problems and stroke problems and health problems in general here in the state of Georgia and all of the country, really, as far as the basic social determinants of health. And we're talking about the American Heart Association and some of the things that they're working on to try and fix this. Let's talk about what the American Heart Association is doing. And Michael, you're the Government Relations Director of the American Heart Association. You deal with a lot of these issues from maybe a legislative standpoint. And talk about some of your programs that you're doing to try to curb these problems.
Currently down at the state capitol, we're working on two programs, the first being a quality PE assessment bill and the second being a telephone CPR bill. So the PE assessment bill deals with gathering data from schools to go ahead and help the Department of Education identify need within our local communities so that they can improve PE systems across the state. And the second, the TCPR bill, would go ahead and require that all 911 dispatchers who deal with medical emergencies are trained in giving instruction on life-saving CPR. throughout the state.
That's not a requirement now.
It is really not a requirement, surprisingly enough. Yeah. You know, they go ahead and they get their certifications, and in that certification, there is no standard on delivering that telephone CPR, and it's left up to the individual organizations that contract these folks out to go ahead and train them. So there is disparity from center to center across the state.
But do many of them do that already, just teach people, or is it the other way around?
Well, there are some. We don't actually have a good amount of data on the amount of folks who are doing it or not. And what we found from going ahead and trying to gather that data is even those that are doing it are using outdated models. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. So there's a real concern over what impact that has on the individuals who might suffer an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest here in the state.
That has saved millions of lives, I would guess, that in the AEDs that are becoming more prevalent here, too. Are you finding that out, doctors? That's certainly making a difference, do you think?
No doubt. The initiative of doing compression-only CPR, which saves you from having had been formally trained in doing mouth-to-mouth and knowing all the different ratios, is an easy thing that everybody can do. And, you know, there's these videos out there that show people doing CPR to a song. My song is
really?
Staying Alive, because the beat
That's right.
of many songs is exactly the ratio of which you should be compressing.
Yeah.
And so the song Staying Alive works really, really well for me and my generation. But everybody has to find their song. I taught my daughter, you know, pick your song. This is the rate we got to do it. And if somebody goes down, this is what you do.
Yeah. They're teaching now compression only. Then you don't have to do this many breaths. It's much easier.
Absolutely.
Now, especially with Staying Alive. Everybody now will go out and start listening to that song.
That's why I said it.
and back to the blood pressure, what are the new guidelines as far as blood pressure?
All right, so great question. Look, the simple version is that 130 over 80 is the new 140 over 90. So in the olden days, we had blood pressure goals that were higher than they are now. We've known for years that 120 over 70 is an optimal blood pressure when it occurs naturally. What we've not known is whether giving multiple medications to achieve that blood pressure has the same benefit. And several studies done recently seem to show that lower is better, although there probably is a little bit higher risk of side effects when you get on multiple medications. But let me give the audience a couple of interesting facts. If we look at 120 over 80 and compare that to 130 over 80, just that slight increase in systolic, which is the upper pressure, doubles the risk of having a heart attack or stroke. It doubles the risk for every 10 millimeters of diastolic or 20 millimeters of systolic, the risk of death from a heart attack or stroke doubles. Those are phenomenal, even at what, you know, most people would think 140 over 85 is not too bad.
Mm-hmm.
It is.
So is it 120 over 80 still?
Well, 120 over 80 would be ideal.
Okay.
What we're looking for is anybody that's higher than that is going to start getting more of an intervention from a physician or a healthcare provider in terms of diet, exercise, weight loss, alcohol reduction, and salt reduction.
Okay. And these new numbers are so important because as we've been talking to patients about them in the office and talking to folks in the community about them, people are having a hard time kind of wrapping their minds around them because I'll hear people say, well, my blood pressure just always runs that way. It always runs high. And so I think that's why it's really important for us to help people to understand how serious these stats are, that just that small increase really does have such a large impact on whether you live or die from high blood pressure.
So that's actually a great point. If you look at what percentage of people that have been diagnosed with hypertension are actually controlled, 45% are not controlled.
Really?
Okay, that's huge. Now, the American Heart Association initiated the Target BP program several years ago in order to raise that from 45% of people that are not controlled to get 70% that are controlled. Through a series of initiatives and training and resources that the AHA can offer, we want healthcare providers through the state of Georgia to push really hard to get these blood pressures down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It makes a big difference in the incidence of heart failure, heart attack, and death.
Now, I know that obviously diet and exercise, we keep going back to that, does have an impact on blood pressure, but the medications, that percentage is uncontrolled, is it people that just won't, obviously don't go to the doctor, they're not compliant in taking their medication, or they take it incorrectly, is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Yeah, all of the above.
I mean, people don't like to take their medicines. It is hard to lose weight, but it's important to know that a 10-pound weight loss will lead to a 5-millimeter reduction in blood pressure, and that 5-millimeter reduction and blood pressure lowers the risk of stroke 14%, heart disease by 9%, and overall mortality by 7%. That's right. 10 pounds.
What is your Target BP program?
Target BP actually predated these new guidelines. So Target BP came out several years ago. It's a set of initiatives that the AHA puts out. People sign up to be part of Target BP. And the idea is that by using different resources the AHA offers, filling out certain forms, looking at your population, and reporting them back, we can encourage the healthcare providers to get people down to goal blood pressures, to encourage their patients to do all these different things we've been talking about. So Target BP is something that actually started even before the new guidelines. And in the Target BP initial guidelines, they were higher than what they are now.
Target BP has been around for a while, and it's a fantastic program. What I really appreciate, though, is that the American Heart Association is really looking at what additional strategies should we be thinking about to help to bring people within that range of the Target BP. And this is, again, where social determinants of health come in. So you asked, why don't people always take their medicines? Sometimes it's just because they don't like the way it makes them feel, or they're worried about side effects. But quite honestly, sometimes it's because they can't afford them, or they don't have a way to get to the pharmacy to pick them up. Or perhaps, you know, there are other reasons that are tied to social determinants of health. They had to go to work and they weren't able to get back in and get their refill. These are all things that I deal with a lot in the primary care setting. And so I really appreciate that the association is trying to help people to really work through all of those things. And this is a good opportunity for us to remind folks to really put some emphasis on those things in their own lives so that their blood pressure can really become in the range where it should be.
As far as medications, some people take one, low dose, high dose, whatever, but some people take multiple. You touched on that earlier. Why is that? Why do you have the multi work together? How do you explain that?
Well, sometimes it takes more than one. In this most recent trial that helped lead us down this path of lower blood pressure goals, there was a study called SPRINT, which looked at different blood pressure medication regimens. And in the people that took about three pills, they had 20 or 30% reduction in event rate compared to those that were taking one or two. They had a slightly higher risk of side effects, but the point was that if we got the blood pressures down to 120 over 80, there was a lower incidence of heart attack, stroke, and death. In fact, the change was so prominent, they terminated the study early because it was a clear benefit, and they said, we can't really go on doing this randomized trial anymore. We now know that this works.
Tell us about the Complete Streets program you have, too.
Sure. Complete Streets is not necessarily an AHA thing, but we support it. Complete Streets is a transportation policy and a set of guidelines and design elements that basically allow and enable safe access for all users. So pedestrians, people that are using rapid transit, bicyclists, and it's for everybody, including those that are disabled, riders of all ages. You know, we have an issue here in the United States. Compared to our European counterparts, we have 2 to 6 times the incidence of pedestrian accidents for the same amount of road traveled. It's striking because there's something like 13 people dying every day in the United States from being hit by a car. And many times it's due to the fact that there's no sidewalk. That's one of the most important pieces of the puzzle, no sidewalk. I was at a NPU planning unit for my town just 2 days ago, and one of the things I pointed out to them was that when the bridge collapsed last year, I started taking MARTA on a regular basis, which meant walking from Lindbergh to my house in Morningside, about 3 miles. And so I'm riding down or walking down Piedmont and Cheshire Bridge, very heavily trafficked. But my most dangerous part of my travel was the last quarter mile, because my street, for whatever reason, doesn't have sidewalks.
Wow.
And I have to walk on the street with cars flying by. And so sidewalks make a difference. Sidewalks are part of Complete Streets, having different design elements in the street to slow traffic, to make turning lanes accessible, to have raised sidewalks, have real bicycle lanes, maybe making certain streets bicycle-friendly streets so that it keeps cars from going that way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's actually an initiative going on right now through the Complete Streets pathway that was sponsored in 2016 by the City of Atlanta. Raised about $100 million from taxes, and they're spending that over the next 5 years. But Monroe, which is a four-lane road, is going to be probably turned into a three-lane road with a central turning lane, bike lanes, and two traffic lanes. Complete Streets is a healthy program.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It helps reduce heart disease. It encourages people to walk. And one of the issues we have from a social determinant standpoint is that in many of the rural communities, Complete Streets is going to look different than it does in the city of Atlanta.
Right.
Very different.
Yeah.
But many of the lower income areas don't have good crosswalks. I mean, there's an area in Atlanta where, you know, just recently they put in crosswalks to cross Buford Highway. But you were stuck on one side of the road, or you had to cross a six-lane road. You're going to get really hurt pretty badly.
And, Michael, is this something that, from your perspective, you're working on doing as well?
From my perspective, I work mostly on state issues and then smoke-free issues at the local level.
Yeah.
So I assist our local team with the Complete Streets program, but it's not something I'm pushing initially. But I had a hand in it last year, attended some meetings, and it's looking good. I think when we talk about equity with Complete Streets, the city is thinking about that. It's definitely in their program, and I think it has a bright future here.
What about your smoke-free initiatives?
Sure. Well, we've got two in the state, one here in the city of Atlanta and the other in the city of Marietta. And the goal of those is to get a comprehensive smoke-free ordinance passed through the city that would go ahead, each city, that would go ahead and eliminate smoking once and for all from all of the workplaces.
Yeah. You're seeing that more and more.
You are. I mean, it's a trend that is in the best interest of public health on every level.
Yeah.
You know, secondhand smoke can go ahead and increase your chance of stroke by 20 to 30%.
Yeah.
You know, it costs Georgia $1.8 billion to its healthcare industry each year, complications from secondhand smoke and smoking-related illnesses. So
we didn't talk much about stroke, but I want to touch on stroke, too. Obviously, that is a main issue as well, and I would imagine these same things apply not just for heart problems and heart attacks, but strokes as well, correct?
They absolutely do. And you heard me mention the phrase vascular disease earlier. And so stroke is certainly a vascular disease. Something else we don't frequently think about is something called peripheral vascular disease. And so what I tell people is that if you are worried about the blood vessels and the heart and the brain, then you should also be thinking about the smaller blood vessels in the body. We'll get folks who we aren't able to feel good pulses in their feet. There are folks who complain of having cold feet or having leg cramps. It happens a lot in people who smoke. And so, you know, the blood vessels are important, whether it's in the heart and the brain, but also elsewhere in the body.
Wow. What are some things that you would advise our audience to do to begin changing things?
Well, I think, first of all, a more whole food plant-based diet clearly has been shown to reduce disease. So I think that's an important thing. The cost is a minor issue. I think most of the time people use the salty things because they taste better. And you can make healthy foods without having a lot of sodium. When I go to restaurants now, I tell them no salt. Mm-hmm. And it drives them crazy. But I can't eat the salt because I too have blood pressure.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if I eat too much sodium, I get a headache, my pressure goes up. It's not good.
I would say two things. I would certainly second what Dr. Balk just mentioned about increasing vegetables in the diet. And I tell people, you don't have to put a label on it. You don't have to call yourself vegan. You don't have to call yourself vegetarian. But when you make a plate, try to make at least half of it with fruits and vegetables. And my personal goal is for me to eat a plant-based diet about 50 or 75% of the time. Okay. I'd love to do more than that, but at least that. Okay. The second thing is to really commit to physical activity. The recommendations are in the least 30 minutes of physical activity on 5 days of the week. And I think if we really could get people to focus on those two things, we would see an astronomical impact on cardiovascular and vascular diseases in this country.
Michael, from a government relations standpoint, as you mentioned, the legislature is in right now, and I know you're looking for some changes and some initiatives. What can our audience do if these are things they're concerned about?
Two words, get involved. You know, and today's political climate, people are bombarded with news nonstop, and it can be intimidating. But I would say not to let that get in the way of you contacting your representatives, your city council members, your senators, and trying to get real change achieved. You know, we have all of these great priorities, public health priorities, and we need help.
Yeah.
And it's not going to be accomplished without input from the community, and all of those lawmakers want to hear from their constituents.
Let me follow up on that with the Complete Streets movement, because there's really good examples in the United States, one of which in Orlando, they took a big road, I think it's called Edgewater Drive, and it went from four lanes to three lanes. They had bike lanes, streetscape beautifications, and what ended up happening from this, community normally would have never crossed over Edgewood because it was too big of a road. But this change that happened as a result of Complete Streets initiatives reduced crashes 35%. It increased biking and walking 23% and 30% respectively, and in fact spurred economic development. People then enjoy their neighborhood. They're more likely to get out and walk and do these activities. I used to have a rule with my patients, it's called a Balk's Rules of Threes and Fours. 3 to 4 days a week, 30 to 40 minutes, 3 to 4 miles an hour with a 3 to 4% grade. Nobody could walk out of my office not remembering the threes and fours.
That's awesome. Yeah.
That's all you got to do.
That's great. That and staying alive when you're dead. That is great.
That
is great.
That was a great example of social determinants of health.
Yeah.
Here you have, obviously, the health impact. You've got infrastructure on the streets, as well as economic development. I mean, that's amazing, which all of those will just continue to feed to healthy communities. Yeah. It's fantastic.
Thank you all for coming in and talking about this. It's obviously something very, very important that we all could do better in, and I appreciate you guys coming and talking about it. And also, you can find out more information about the work of the American Heart Association at heart.org. Today, we've been talking about the American Heart Association and some of the things that they're doing just for general heart health and also to deal with our country's multicultural population because they are at a disproportionately high risk for cardiovascular disease and stroke. And our guests today have been Dr. Michael Balk, cardiologist and chair of the Metro Atlanta American Heart Association Advisory. Dr. Ayanna Buckner, she is the chair of the Metro Atlanta Multicultural Leadership Committee. And we also have with us today Michael Cortez. He is Government Relations Director for the American Heart Association. We thank them all for coming in and joining us. And, of course, we thank you for listening. And I'll talk to you next week here on Georgia Focus.
You've been listening to Georgia Focus, a public affairs presentation of this station and the Georgia News Network. The views expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of this station or the Georgia News Network. If you have comments or questions about Georgia Focus, contact John Clark at the Georgia News Network at 1-800-776-4638 or email johnclark@georgianewsnetwork.com. Thanks for listening.